The Guardian. Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Nell Bowes. On this week's podcast, we go inside the hidden world of the pathologist.
It's a field where they have put bodies in all sorts of different circumstances to do scientific experiments on or to learn the science of body decomposition.
Look at the science behind Iceland's volcanic disruption.
The same with Mount Pinatubo and Mount Tobo. It nearly wiped out humanity because it brought these, you know, global winters in summer. You know, basically all the sunlight was reflected back.
And the latest on ClimateGate and the hacked emails.
A lot of these things have been happening in the back room. Science has got on with its own agenda behind the scenes, and suddenly the public feels, oh, there's something here we haven't been aware of, and because we haven't been aware of it, therefore it's suspect.
And find out whether cloud whitening is the way to solve Earth's climate problems.
There is an argument that if you promise that the cavalry might be out there ready to ride in and save you, that people will take less seriously solving the problem at its root cause.
I hate the idea of geoengineering, but I hate even more the idea that we're going to cause massive flooding and billions of people will die.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome. In the studio today, we have The Observer's science editor, Robin McKee, and Environment Guardian's James Randerson. We'll hear from them in a moment. Meanwhile, our guest today is broadcaster and science writer Sue Armstrong. Sue has a book out on pathology called A Matter of Life and Death. And today we're going to be talking about pathologists and how they're viewed in society. Sue, hello.
Hi.
Now, your book is a series of interviews with pathologists in very different areas. Can you tell us a bit about how it came about?
Well, it came about as a direct result of the scandal or controversy, whatever you like to call it, at Alder Hey in the late 90s when families who had had their children, had postmortems done on their children at the Alder Hey Children's Hospital and also after the deaths in Bristol, discovered that the organs had been retained. And there was a huge hoo-ha, and suddenly the media got onto this and they started calling them doctors of death. And a friend of mine got in touch with me and said, they're calling us doctors of death. And I thought, this sounds a really interesting thing for some radio. So I put up the idea to the Beeb of doing some programmes looking at what kind of people go into pathology and what they really do. And the broadcasts were great fun to do. And a few years later, a book came out of it. I decided to do the same sort of thing for a book.
There's an amazing collection of stories. There's ranging from the ghoulish to the just straightforwardly fascinating. I think the most ghoulish is the body farm. Can you tell us a bit about the chap who owns the body farm?
Well, I had to do the body farm because as a journalist, I had seen stories about the body farm and I'd often wanted to do something on it but never got the chance. So I thought, well, when I go to the States, I'm jolly well going to go and interview Bill Bass. And I got to Tennessee and expected to go and interview him in his office or at home. And he just put me in the car and said, I'm going to take you down to the facility. And the facility happens to be this, literally, it's a field where they have put bodies in all sorts of different circumstances to do scientific experiments on or to learn the science of body decomposition. And that came about because Bill Bass realised when he was working for police departments that one of the most difficult things to get right is how long a body has been dead. And he looked up in the literature, he couldn't find stuff on maggots, he couldn't find stuff on anything. And so he kept thinking about this. And then one time he had a body and he identified the sex of the body and the age of the person and so on. But he was 112 years out. Well, how long the body had been dead, they subsequently discovered. And he thought, we really need some studying of this. So that's what he did. He got a patch of land and bodies have been put out there and they've been done masses and masses of scientific studies on exactly the processes of decomposition.
Pathology isn't all about the forensics, is it? I mean, you've got sort of some interesting
it isn't.
Examples of the discovery of the flu virus and things like that.
Yes, it absolutely isn't. And one of the good reasons for doing the book was to get rid of this idea that it's all about what people see on CSI, that it's all about bodies coming out of canals and how long have they been dead and that sort of stuff, and all about postmortems. In fact, that's a minority side of pathology. The rest of it is literally what backs up the NHS service. They are the expert diagnosticians. They're the people working in the labs who, when you're told by your oncologist that you've got cancer, it will be a pathologist who identifies exactly what sort of cancer and who's there when the surgery is being done and will say to the surgeon, yes, you've taken enough, or no, you need to take a bit more, the margins aren't clear. All of those sort of things go on behind the scenes, and those are the pathologists. So they're vital.
Now, we've got observers Robin McKee in here. Robin, you've got a question for Sue.
Yeah, I want to know where the body farm gets the bodies from.
That's what everybody asks. Well, originally, they got them from unclaimed bodies from the morgue, and these were probably down and outs who'd been there for a long time and nobody'd come for them. But very quickly, you know, this is the sort of thing that makes a good story, and so people learnt about it, and now they get more bodies left, somebody said, not on their doorstep, but left to them, bequeathed to them in people's wills, than they do unclaimed bodies. They're people who say, it's a good idea, people need to learn from my body, you can have it.
I just want to bring in here James Randerson. James.
I just wanted to take you back to Alderhay and the effects of that, because at the time, you know, it was really, you know, there were some, as you say, very nasty things said about pathologists, and it conjured up a sort of ghoulish image of the profession. And also it had an effect via things like the Human Tissue Act, extra regulations on the sort of bureaucratic hoops you need to go through in order to use body parts from people, or even things like urine samples. What kind of effect has that had in terms of the little bits of research that pathologists used to be able to do with body parts that they had?
Well, people are really worried about that. I mean, the immediate effect, as you say, was that it had a very strong immediate effect. A lot of pathologists left the profession, particularly the paediatric pathologists, because they were being vilified, and some of them were having their children taunted at school and so on. It was that bad. They were sort of like hangmen. That's how they were being seen. So people left the profession. People didn't sign up to become pathologists, and they had a big gap in recruitment of pathologists. This is deadly serious because, I mean, practically everything, all the advances in medicine take place are come from research on diseased bodies and bits and pieces and so on. And if you can't do that easily, it's going to have an effect. But, you know, you get a mix of the pathologists. Some are really worried and say it's just dreadful. It's deterring young pathologists from doing interesting little bits of research because they have to jump through ethical hoops to get hold of anything, as you say, anything with human cells, blood or urine. But others say, no, we're learning to live with it and it's okay.
I mean, my perception, certainly in the wider society, is that pathology is becoming more of a kind of, you've got CSI, you've got Kathy Reichs and Bones and that kind of forensic anthropology end of it, and you've got sort of, they're emerging as kind of characters that people know about. Is that a good thing, or is it actually just too much? It's a caricature and it's sort of misleading.
It's a good thing in as much as it stimulates people's interest, and that's always a good thing. And certainly in my book, originally I wasn't going to have a lot of forensic people in. But then the publisher said, well, you're crazy not to have the thing that brings people in. But most of the book is about people who aren't in forensics. They are looking at cancer, looking at new diseases. I mean, both AIDS and new variant CJD, it was the pathologists who were responsible for being on the track of a new disease, saying these are the new symptoms, what's behind it, learning to understand what was going on in the body.
So tell us about the Creutzfeldt-Jakob case. What did they look at?
Well, I went to see James Ironside, who's a neuropathologist, so he works on brains, and he knew a lot about Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease. And he then joined the BSE, the mad cow disease team, to see what was going to happen in human beings. And he said he very much remembers looking down the microscope and suddenly seeing something very different. It was the same disease. It had the same a lot of the same characteristics, but the plaques that he was seeing under the microscope were just very different from anything he'd seen before. And all kinds of alarm bells rang. And it was a much younger patient than the normal ones they saw. And then, of course, they went backwards and forwards looking everywhere else to see if this was just a typical case, but they'd never seen it and they were looking all over the world. And then they realised, yes, this is new. And they went to WHO and WHO put them through their paces. The World Health Organization then said, yes, OK, you've got something new.
And the thing that always gets me when I speak to forensic experts, and I'm sure it's the same for forensic pathologists, is what drives them mad about programmes like CSI is people say, give me a DNA profile of this, and it comes back in half an hour. when it takes a week and everybody's gnashing their teeth. I mean, that's the sort of the way they compress and speed it up, where in fact the whole process is lengthy and laborious and painstaking, isn't it?
Absolutely. And the other thing about the tele programmes is they're always beautifully dressed and they want this thing. And it's as though, OK, I'll get this back, I'll know what it is. Whereas it's an incredibly painstaking process, looking at stuff, wondering, talking to your colleagues. But that's not cinematic.
No, it wouldn't be, would it?
it's apparently having an effect on juries as well, because the people talk about the CSI effect, that juries expect the forensic evidence to be cut and dried in a case, and of course it never is. Yes. There's always some level of interpretation, and so it becomes easier for the defence expert to come in and say, well, it might be this, it might be that, and then the jury's very confused.
And in fact, there's a bit in my book, one of my interviewees does spend a lot of time actually as an expert witness, and she said exactly that. She said, you have to realise it's not science, it's drama in the courtroom. The jury will like how you look or not like how you look, so she said you have to be aware of all of that. And sometimes they'll want a yes or no answer with some incredibly abstruse science, and you haven't time to say, can I have 20 minutes just to explain to you what this is? And she said sometimes the judge will say, oh well, we don't think that's right, and it might be about a bit of science that the scientific community has been arguing about for ages. So she said it's a really different environment, and you have to know what you're doing.
Well, if you want to read Sue Armstrong's book, it's called A Matter of Life and Death, and it's out now. Leave your thoughts on the blog at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Make sure you subscribe for free while you're there, so every podcast gets automatically delivered to your MP3 device. Takes all the hard work out of listening.
Science Weekly.
Now, something we haven't talked about for a while. Geoengineering. Some of the latest ideas and research on large-scale plans to cool the planet have been on show at an event at London's Science Museum. You got the chance to try your hand at capturing CO2 and even take part in a silent disco, although I'm not quite sure how that helps save the planet. We went along to check it out and started by asking Chris Rapley, director of the Science Museum, what is geoengineering?
Well, it's any large-scale, sort of global-scale intervention by humans to compensate for global warming through the release of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And there are two general categories of intervention. One is to sort of reflect back radiation to the sun, so you cool the planet that way. There are a variety of ways you do that, whitening clouds, changing the albedo of urban areas by painting everything white, pumping stuff up into the stratosphere, or having space mirrors. A whole variety of ways that people are proposing to do that. And then the second way is to try and remediate the atmosphere, to suck carbon dioxide back out of the atmosphere, given that that's where we've dumped it. And I have to say that my strong feeling is that the latter, if we have to engage at all, is preferable, not least because if you just try and reflect back the sunlight, you're not doing anything for ocean acidification, and what's more, you're committing all future generations to maintain whatever system that you put in place, because should it fail, then you'll very quickly get the full brunt of the warming that you've introduced through the greenhouse effect.
I'm Vicky Pope, I'm Head of Climate Change Advice at the Met Office Hadley Centre. We've used the climate model to look at the impacts of cloud seeding. So we've made an assumption that you could actually make a significant difference to clouds by seeding them, and then looked at what the implications would be for the global climate. Now, in order to have a big impact on the radiation, on the amount of sunlight reaching the surface, you'd need to seed the clouds in the areas which are already strong regions of stratocumulus, as low-level cloud. And if you do that, then you get a very uneven pattern of cloud change, which changes the global circulation. It will change the rainfall patterns all over the world. And it's possible that it could actually make it drier over the Amazon. Now, our models already suggest that the Amazon could become drier in future and then the rainforest could die back. And so this would actually make this worse. So although the temperature wouldn't be as high, we'd still get the rainforest die back. So you might improve the climate in one part of the world, but at the expense of another part of the world, which clearly would have implications in terms of actually agreeing it internationally.
Tim Lenton, I'm a professor of Earth System Science at the University of East Anglia.
Why do you think that land-based solutions are better than sequestering in the oceans?
Because I've done some thorough calculations on this, and I know that the numbers just don't work with the ocean-based options. You could have a global effort for a century and still only make a dent of at most a few tens of parts per million in the global carbon dioxide level in the atmosphere, whereas a concerted effort with a combination of chemical and plant-based methods on land, you could be more in the ballpark of 100 or a couple of hundred parts per million. So quantitatively, both it's easier to work on land, obviously we're much more familiar with it, so if cost comes into it, it's almost certainly going to be more cost effective, but really it's because it has much more climate effectiveness.
My name is Alan Gaddian. I'm an NCAS, that's National Centre for Atmospheric Science, senior scientist. In essence, I don't think any of these re-engineering climate ideas are really very wise. However, the solution for the present crisis would be to use the cloud whitening idea. The stratospheric aerosol is not a good idea because it has lots of governance and lots of implications. Cloud whitening is a process where we inject seawater into stratus clouds, which layer clouds, which cover a third of the ocean. And these layer clouds are full of little droplets. And these droplets reflect the sunlight. So the cloud whitening is to increase the number of droplets by injecting salt crystals, so you'll have more droplets in these clouds. You probably won't be able to see it with the naked eye, but we'd increase the amount of solar radiation reflected back to space. And this, in fact, ironically, if you do it over the equatorial regions, it will make the poles a lot cooler. So what we've already been doing, if you go off to the coast of Chile and Peru, you'll see this heavily banded, polluted air, because they've put aerosols, car exhaust, smelter exhaust into the atmosphere. These exhausts actually remove cloud because you can overdo it. You can overdo it and get rid of the clouds. So you see where we've actually been polluting the clouds and actually making them disappear. So I'd like to emphasize that mankind is geoengineering the planet now. We have taken control of it, whether we like it or not. And if we don't, and the planet will have its revenge if we do nothing. It will want to return to a stable state, and that will mean a lot hotter temperatures, a lot more floods, and a lot more chaos.
My name is Victoria Johnson. I'm the senior climate change researcher at the New Economics Foundation in London. The idea about the moral hazard is that once you start talking about geoengineering, it kind of creates this kind of complacency within sort of society in a way, you know, whether it's politicians or whether it's actual individuals thinking that there's some kind of get out clause or some kind of magic bullet that's going to save us all. And the problem with that is that if that has any impact on mitigation, which it potentially could do, if you look at other examples of moral hazards, so in the insurance industry or the other example of this kind of levee effect in sort of, you know, building on floodplains, which are very hazardous areas, when you have a sort of a dam or a levee in the area, if that actually does mean that there's some complacency in mitigation, then it's almost as if we're kind of tempting fate in a way.
When I first got involved in climate change science donkeys years ago, you weren't allowed to use the word adaptation, because the argument was, oh gosh, if you start to talk about adaptation, then you've given up the ghost, you know, you're no longer going to mitigate, people will think they don't have to mitigate, we'll all adapt. And then more recently, the word that you couldn't use was remediate, and now people are saying, oh gosh, you know, well, if we haven't done a very good job on mitigation and adaptation, maybe we should remediate as well, take carbon out of the atmosphere. Frankly, I think the best thing to do is do a bit of research into all these areas and try and understand, you know, what the problems are. It may be that humans don't grapple with the mitigation and the adaptation, and we may be in such a desperate situation we have to consider doing some geoengineering. So having done some basic research into what the risks are ahead of time would be a smart thing to do. It's an insurance policy.
If we do nothing now and there are impending disasters around the world, then people are going to do this. The US military is going to do it, or I'm not saying necessarily US military. India or China will do it. And we need to have a constructive understanding. And maybe in 6 years' time, we'll know the side effects, and then somebody else can make a decision. And that decision will have to be made by governments. But if you don't have the scientific knowledge, then you can't make a rational decision. I hate the idea of geoengineering, but I hate even more the idea that we're going to cause massive flooding and billions of people will die. That is the other option.
That was Sonja van Gilder-Cook asking the questions at London's Science Museum. So talking about injecting vast amounts of particles into the upper atmosphere, Robin, do we think that the Iceland volcano will have any effect on cooling?
If it keeps up, yes, it could. I mean, if it keeps spewing that out and you get, for instance, when Krakatoa went off,
1815?
Something, no, a little later than that. 1860 or... Everyone's shaking their heads. In the late 19th century. So we had a very, very poor winter. And the same with Mount Pinatubo and Mount Toba. It nearly wiped out humanity because it brought these, you know, global winters in summer. You know, basically all the sunlight was reflected back. So the principle is going to be of geoengineering, at least one aspect of it, is going to be demonstrated by, possibly demonstrated by the Iceland volcano. I think Chris Rapley, in his introductory remarks, I think makes the most intelligent remark there. I mean, it was rather a good 7 minutes there, I thought. It was extremely interesting and raised a lot of good issues. But as you say, you've got two forms of geoengineering. You stop sunlight coming in by putting particles or mirrors or something around the Earth, or you actually sequester the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Well, the problem about the first one is most of the things you do are going to be completely out of control. And secondly, it won't stop carbon dioxide being pumped into the atmosphere, and that in turn will not stop our oceans becoming more and more acidic. And that's really one of the problems about climate change, man-made climate change, that we really haven't faced up to. And therefore, the answer is in some way to suck the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And that's big engineering, but there's absolutely no reason. I mean, that's the only way forward, I think. And it's big engineering, but it's something we should be thinking about now, thinking about the practicalities, because indeed we may sit about and one day the planet will be fucked. Well, I got my swearing in.
Do you think the lady in the middle had a point about complacency mitigation, as she called it, i.e. about thinking that if we get these big projects off the ground, then we'll be fine, and actually meaning that people don't change their behaviours in the way they need to do it?
Basically, that has been going on for a long time. This was the George Bush argument about why he wasn't going to sign up to Kyoto, because somehow in the future we'll have the science that will get rid of the carbon dioxide for us. And that massive complacency by the world superpower for 8 years. So, I mean, yes, it's a real problem. The trouble is that nobody has yet come up with a credible piece of technology that allows us to be complacent. And we shouldn't be complacent. We should be stopping pumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
Sue Armstrong, what do you think about the debate that's going on?
Well, I think one of the lessons of the past is that we've got to have a massive public debate about this, because there will be lots of little bits of technology being developed and they will all have global implications. Therefore, they stand the risk of going the same way as the biotech debate, where you've got biotechnology for plants and this sort of thing, and suddenly nobody wanted biotech plants.
There was the whole scare stories about genetic modification.
Genetically modified plants. They didn't want that as far as food is concerned. And you could have some good ideas which were stymied by the public feeling they hadn't been involved in this. So again, it's got to be one of these things where the science is being done and the science is being supported and seeing what it can do, but there has to be massive involvement of people who are going to be affected.
If you follow this podcast on Twitter, at Science Weekly, we'll let you know every time a new podcast is launched. And to be alerted to all the Guardian Science content, follow at Guardian Science.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
Let's have a look now at some of the other science stories around this week.
News Jack. A long-running libel case over a Guardian Science article has been dropped. The British Chiropractic Association has ended its legal action against Simon Singh. The case had become a cause célèbre, with scientists, celebrities and freedom of speech campaigners lining up to condemn British libel laws, arguing Singh had a right to express his opinion in print. He was sued by the BCA for his comment piece 2 years ago, which criticised the association for defending chiropractors who use treatments for which there is little evidence on children with conditions such as colic and asthma.
Eruption disruption. Volcanic ash from Iceland has been grounding thousands of flights across Europe. It's been done for good reason. The particles ejected wreck jet engines. It's so fine it'll invade the spaces between rotating machinery and jam it. The silica melts at about 1,100 Celsius and fuses onto the turbine blades, as parts of the aircraft operate at 1,400 Celsius. Ash can also pit the pilot's windscreen and damage the fuselage. It can even coat the plane so much that it becomes tail heavy. And if the ash lands on runways, it can get thrown up and into engines.
An attempt to oust the governing council of one of Britain's most revered scientific establishments failed last week. Rebel members of the 211-year-old Royal Institution called for the removal of the entire board of trustees. It follows the controversial ousting of the former director, Lady Greenfield. That happened after a review of its finances revealed the organisation was £2.5 million in debt.
The scientists at the centre of the climate emails scandal have been cleared of malpractice. An independent inquiry into the affair says they were disorganised but did not fudge their results. The inquiry also found absolutely no evidence of any impropriety whatsoever.
So, James, Simon Singh finally in the clear.
I'd just like to reflect on, you know, his sort of personal courage, really, in taking this on. Because, I mean, you know, clearly he's got the money to be able to do it, but, you know, he risked a large amount of cash. I mean, I think he's spent $200,000 up to this point, and if it had gone to the next stage, you know, it would have been, you know, much more money. And he did it at a time when it looked very, very unlikely that he'd actually win, and he was doing it in order to make a point about Britain's libel laws, which are stifling journalism, I think, and they're also stifling legitimate scientific debate, which is, you know, in my view, exactly what he was engaged in.
I think he's a hero, and good luck to him. And now what we want is proper legislation that will sweep away this sort of thing, because there are other people who are looking at treatments from other medical treatments who are being threatened with the same libel laws. It's not going to go away now just because of what's happened to Simon, but if it's followed up with prompt legislation by the next government, then hopefully we will get rid of this. But no, Simon's a hero as far as I'm concerned.
I think there's a real head of steam now behind the idea of libel reform, you know, from various different angles. And, you know, all the parties have made noises about it to some degree. I think the Liberal Democrats have probably the most comprehensive changes in mind, but both Labour and the Tories are also hinting that they'll do things. So, you know, I think this is quite a moment, and you know, there could be real change coming, hopefully.
Sue, have you been following the case?
I have, yes. And as you ask about whether it's been stifling, whether it threatens to stifle scientific debate, I think there's even a case at the moment where somebody has been sued for libel about something he said at a scientific conference. I can't remember exactly who it was or what it was, but it was in the US. And I mean, this is appalling, because surely those are the places where debate takes place, and anything can be thrown into the...
Well, because of the sort of libel tourism that goes on, because Britain's libel laws are so conducive to the complainant, it means that people come here and, you know, even if the remark was made somewhere else, published somewhere else, if it's on the web, then they can come here and make their point, if they've got enough money.
Talking about other things in the open arena and debating, how do you feel about the climate change inquiry's findings, James?
Well, this is the second of three official inquiries into
the climate.
So we've
got another one to come.
There's one more to come. The one that's headed by senior civil servant Muir Russell is due in weeks or maybe a couple of months. He's been a little bit vague about exactly when. That inquiry and the one that reported this week, which was looking specifically at the science, were both funded by the University of East Anglia, although the inquiries are independent. This one, the appointees to the panel were advised on by the Royal Society. The previous inquiry was the parliamentary one. In terms of what they had to say, they completely, sense, this is, I suppose, the most important inquiry, because it's saying, is the research that they carried out suspect in any way? Can we rely on the papers? And, you know, the emphatic answer was yes, although they did have some things to say about whether they were using the most up-to-date statistics. But just leaving that aside
It feels slightly coincidental that they've kind of, if they've used slightly incorrect statistical techniques but come up with the right answer.
Well, there's sort of using the wrong statistics and using the wrong statistics, I think. I think arguably they probably should have been more using, you know, the state of the art statistically, but you know, the panel were very clear that it wouldn't have made any difference, and it could have been better on that front. But I think that that is a criticism you could level at almost every academic, because statistics is sort of a separate field on its own, which not everyone is kind of really up to date in. In a sense, though, although these are the most important questions, the really interesting questions haven't been addressed yet by either of the inquiries, or not in any detail. And those
are really interesting
in the sense that we didn't, you know, that they're more controversial and we don't really know the answers. I mean, I think it's no surprise that this inquiry came out with the answer it did. For me, the interesting questions are around the way the scientists sort of operated behind closed doors in terms of access to information, freedom of information requests, data requests for data and emails and things like that, and in terms of the sort of window thrown on the way peer review operates, and you know, the sort of discussions that go on around peer review. I mean, we never really had it as comprehensive a window into that before, and so, you know, it'd be interesting to see to what extent Muir Russell really delves into those questions.
I think what this does expose is the general public's lack of appreciation of how the scientific process works. And science works by the process of disproof. You set something up and you try and knock it down, and you try and knock it down. And that's what scientists do. They try and disprove everything all the time. And I don't think the public realises that. And I think that's why so much confusion has surrounded things like the email gate here. On a general point, I think it's a wonderful report. That's the second one this week on top of Simon Singh. I mean, two bloody noses for the cults of unreason. I think it's absolutely wonderful.
So you don't think
wonderful.
It was whitewash from Lord Oxborough?
I don't think it was whitewash. It was palpably obvious from the beginning. There was absolutely nothing really behind the email gate. But as James quite rightly points out, there is this issue about how scientists in this position are going to have to deal with freedom of information applications. And the problem is that climate change is just another part of science, but we're asking people to change a great deal of their lives, and therefore we have to make it very clear and obvious and upfront about why it's going on, and is the science sound? The science is sound, but we have to show it's sound, and that's the real difficulty.
But it's interesting that you talk about the disproof, in that, you know, scientists are human beings too. They're not going to, you know, beautifully try and disprove each other's points. Some of them will be trying to hold on to their theses and try and
well, you hold on to your own theses, but you try and knock somebody else's down. You know, and that's the name of the game.
But you can't sort of idealise the process. It's got personalities in there, and there's, you know, there are people who are carrying a torch for certain things, and
yes,
that's kind of, I think, the idea that that shouldn't be allowed, that somehow makes the whole methodology invalid, is just not realistic, is it?
I'm not suggesting it. I mean, that's the way it happens, and it's got to happen. And, you know, you may not be a nice person that's trying to knock down your ideas, but you have to live with it. Your ideas have to be sound enough to stand it.
Sue, have you feel strongly about
this? Yes, well, I do. I think there are parallels with the pathology issue that I got waded into, because I think a lot of these things have been happening in the back room. Science has got on with its own agenda behind the scenes. And suddenly the public feels, oh, there's something here we haven't been aware of. And because we haven't been aware of it, therefore it's suspect. And then they pick up the story, and the fact that it's been so secretive becomes the story. And they don't then, but you don't get the feeling that the media or anybody else is really interested in knowing the truth of the issue. They're just exercised by the fact that it's been secretive. And I think climate emails, that's the same sort of thing as with pathology. And you have a long way to row back from that kind of distrust that builds up.
One thing that the emails brought up is the sort of difference in attitude that the scientists had to people who they, even if they were the critics of their work, who were professional scientists, they were generally much more prepared to engage with them than people who they saw as perhaps mavericks, cranks, amateurs, who were out there and were not trying to do their own work, but were trying to pick holes in their work, which is obviously happens in science, but scientists, the scientific process sort of advances by sort of doing your own version of it and saying, well, we come to a completely different conclusion, so your one must be wrong, rather than that there's sort of less of taking all the data that someone else has got and going through it with a fine tooth comb and saying, oh, you've missed a dotted I there and a cross T there. And this sort of process of these kind of self-appointed climate auditors like Steve McIntyre, who runs the climate audit website in the US, I mean, he became a sort of hate figure amongst the scientists because I think they sort of had this attitude, well, who is he to come along and say he's going to audit us? I mean, what are his credentials? What are his qualifications? And my impression from the emails is that they basically refused to sort of engage with that. And that comes out, you know, in them being rather resistant to Freedom of Information Act.
But they
requests.
Need to at some point, that, you know, all these people who are behind closed doors need to, or they do get pilloried, don't they? That's the problem. And it can backfire, which is jolly sad, really.
But I think this is a fascinating distinction in science between the crank and the sort of valid critic, because you do get, you know, the sort of hordes of cranks and the kind of the flat earthers.
And they had plenty of them sending in, email requests to them. I mean, there were definitely requests that were, just trying to make mischief.
You see the way some scientists dress, it would be very hard not to spot the crank there.
Well, exactly. How does one, there's clearly a line between crank and critic, and yet how does one decide where it lies?
Fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your point of view, scientists don't get to decide now, because there is a law of freedom of information and they have to follow the law in the way that other public institutions do. And so I just don't think they've kind of got used to that yet, or many academic institutions are probably waking up to it now after looking at ClimateGate and thinking, oh dear.
For everything you need to know on all these stories, go to guardian.co.uk/science or environmentguardian.co.uk. You can join our Facebook group. We've handily called ourselves the Guardian Science Weekly podcast. You can chat with other listeners and post comments on the wall. And we'll message you every Monday when a new podcast is uploaded. My thanks to Sue Armstrong. Thank you, Sue.
Thank you.
Her book, A Matter of Life and Death, is out now. My thanks to James and also to Robin. Robin, can you tell us what are on the Observer's science pages this week?
Yes, the definitive piece on cat genetics. Where your domestic tabby's from? Middle East, where is the, and what's its impact on the Scottish wildcat, the most northerly population of European wildcats. So, and a lovely graphic to go with it as well.
Great stuff. Next week, we explore the future of brain imaging. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth, with thanks also to Sonia Van Gilder Cook. I'm Nell Bowes. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.